For decades, the mafia had New York City in a stranglehold, with law enforcement seemingly powerless to intervene.
It uses terror to extort people.
But the murder of Carmichael Conti marked the beginning of the end.
It sent the message that we can prosecute these people.
Listen to Law & Order Criminal Justice System on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Katie Couric. You know, if you've been following me on social media, you know I love to cook, or at least try, especially alongside some of my favorite chefs and foodies, like Benny Blanco, Jake Cohen, Lighty Hoik, Allison Roman, and Ina Garten. So I started a free newsletter called Good Taste to share recipes, tips, and kitchen must-haves. Just sign up at katiecouric.com/goodtaste. That's KATIECOURIC.com/goodtaste. I promise your taste buds will be happy you did.
How do you feel about biscuits? Hi, I'm Akilah Hughes, and I'm so excited about my new podcast, Rebel Spirit, where I head back to my hometown in Kentucky and try to convince my high school to change their racist mascot, the Rebels, into something everyone in the South loves, the biscuits.
I was a lady rebel. Like, what does that even mean?
Right here in black and white in print. So they lie.
Bigger than a flag or mascot.
Listen to Rebel Spirit on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On a hot day in June, I drove to a quiet residential neighborhood just outside of Austin, Texas, to visit Andre Causey.
Hello.
I'm Maggie.
Hi, I'm Andre.
Nice to meet you. Thank you. Yes, nice house.
Although the house is large and spacious, Andre doesn't need much to be happy. He enjoys the little things in life, like his fish aquarium.
As a matter of fact, I got that fish aquarium off the side of the road.
The aquarium sits right at the entrance of his house. You'll probably hear it bubbling throughout our interview. It's adorned with artificial plants and a little sign that says, no fishing.
The big one in there, the goldfish, is the first one that I got that my wife went and got. They didn't want to sell it to her. Because she said, I was going to try to see if they were going to live. And they said, oh, we can't sell you no fish if you're going to kill them.
Oh, no.
But I got them. And then we ended up going back and buying some more. I got some more allergy eaters. This is my first fish aquarium, so I think I'm doing pretty good.
Today, Andre is doing pretty good. He takes pride in raising his fish. He's nicknamed them his grandbabies, since he doesn't have any of his own yet.
Because that's all the grandkids we have. Yeah, they're the only grandkids we have. Our children doesn't have any kids.
Andre spent decades in prison for murder. He told me on beautiful days like today, he'd look outside and daydream about a life like this one. Simple, with the people and fish he loves.
Yeah, my name is Alan Andre Causey, and I was convicted of 50 years for this crime. I ended up doing 31 years and 4 months before I was released on parole.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Andre Causey. Alan Andre Causey, who goes by Andre, was born on March 26th, 1965.
I got 4 brothers and a sister. I'm the 3rd oldest out of 6 kids. It's 5 boys and 1 girl.
At an early age, Andre's parents divorced, and his mom moved the kids to Austin, Texas.
We come up here in 73. So 73, I was about 8 years old because I was born in 65. I used to go back home and stay a year, 6 months, and spend time down there with... I was still one of my mama's sisters and spend time with my dad and all them on that end down there, but... You know, me and my dad and them, we got along good. I don't actually know what happened between him and my mom because we were young. But we moved here, and my mama moved us up here to give us a better life, get us out of the country because we country boys, you know.
Austin was very different from his home in Louisiana. Not better or worse, just more to do.
Well, I mean, we was young kids, so, you know, it was all new. But, you know, we had a more wide and broad space to move around, you know, and we met friends and, you know.
Andre's mom was a beautician and worked hard to support 5 kids. Eventually, she opened up her own shop, leaving Andre and his siblings exploring the new city on their own. Andre says they eventually made friends and met a particularly influential older lady.
We met this old lady. Her name was Miss Joanna, but we called her Honey. But she told us a lot.
Honey was sort of a stand-in mom.
What were some things that you remember her teaching you?
Well, you know, she taught us to always work for what we want. You know, don't expect nobody to just give you anything, you know, give you something, you know. Always, you know, work. You know, people gonna help you if you're trying to help yourself.
Andre says that Honey initially hired him and his siblings to help her out with things like yard work.
She had a garage where she'd do garage sales, and she'd go around to other garages and buy stuff and bring it to hers. And she taught us how to get around Austin and all that.
And Honey treated the kids as her own.
We went everywhere, and her favorite place to eat was Long John Silver. So that's why I'm not crazy about Long John Silver, because that's all she fed us.
Wow.
Andre was a hard worker from an early age. It was really all he knew. When Andre was in 10th grade, he dropped out of high school and started working a variety of jobs, he says, including at UT Austin in the kitchen as a dishwasher. He also did some construction work. Andres's life was simple, just how he liked it.
You know, because I was just out having fun.
What was having fun? What were you
I
doing?
I just like to go out and just enjoy people and have fun. You know, people that I knew, you know, we sit around, drink beer, and just have fun. No.
Were you getting in any kind of trouble?
No, ma'am.
No run-ins with the law?
No.
Andre says around 18 or 19, he got a girl pregnant.
At that time that we were doing our thing, it was just a lust thing on both our behalves, you know, so it wasn't any feelings.
Andre says because the relationship wasn't serious, you know, no feelings, he wasn't allowed in his son's life.
Last time I seen him was like maybe 2 days before I got arrested. And he was like 3-4 years old then.
Andre never had a relationship with his own son.
I don't know if he knew me. I don't know what his mama told me about him.
But a few years later, he became a stepdad to a baby girl. With a woman he'd love for decades to come.
How would you describe him?
Sexy. He was okay. Sexy.
This is Delonda.
Delonda Harold Causey, and I'm the wife of Alan Andre Causey.
How'd y'all meet?
We met in some apartment complex on the east side. I used to go visit my auntie in the summertime, and I met Andre.
Her auntie stayed next door to my mother, and that's how we met. Matter of fact, my little brother up under me is married to her first cousin.
No way.
Yeah, they used to come visit her. That's how we met.
What stood out to you? Like, did you just see him across the complex?
He was cute. He was cute, and he knew, and I always told him, I know you cute. He was just an outgoing person. He had some little bow legs. He was fine. He used to wear shorts, and he played basketball at the basketball court. So I would sit up there and watch him on the steps.
Delonda watched Andre for years.
When I first met him, I was like 15. 16.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was still in high school. You know, during the summertime, like when I would come home or go over to see my aunt and visit her, I would always see him. But then I left and went to college, and then I came back. And then when I actually graduated from college, I think that's when we really got serious. I came out of the beauty shop one day.
Andre's mom was actually Delonda's beautician. So she comes out of the beauty shop one day to Andre.
And he's like, here come my wife. I'm like, I'm not your wife. And then we just connected and been together ever since.
Delonda had just given birth to her daughter, Ronisha, when they got serious.
And he came in and stepped in and was a father figure to my daughter. I say he had my daughter more than I had her. And he just came in and became a helpmeet to me.
That's amazing. So he was a good dad.
He's very good with kids.
I always been a family type person. I love being with family. I love spending time with my family.
Unfortunately, Delonda and Andre would never be able to have their own kid together. Just about a year after they officially started dating, Andre would be arrested for murder. On Monday evening, August 12th, 1991, Andre was at home with his 9-month-old daughter, and Delonda was cooking dinner.
She fixed some tacos. I never will forget it. She fixed some tacos. That was my last meal. And I was sitting outside talking to some of the guys that stayed in the same apartment, and we were just talking and listening to music, and two guys walk up in suits. And we looking, and they say, well, they walk up, they look at the back of the car, and we just look at them. They say, well, who's driving this car? And I said, I am, sir.
It was a maroon Oldsmobile Toronado.
And he said, well, we need to talk to you. I said, okay, well, let me take my daughter in the house.
Delonda asked what was going on.
She asked, who is that? I said, it's the police. They want to talk to me. So they said, well, can you go down to the police station? I said, yes.
Officers Mike Huckabee and Bruce Boardman took Andre to the station.
He was taken in for questioning and endured a 7-hour coercive interrogation by a Hector Polanco-led Austin Police Department homicide unit.
This is Jesse Freud, senior staff attorney at the Innocence Project of Texas.
45 minutes into what they initially call an interview, two officers tell him that they don't believe the story he gives about why he's driving this car.
Remember, when the police showed up at Andre's house, they asked him about a car parked outside, a maroon Oldsmobile Toronado. That's because at a taped-up murder scene in Andre's apartment complex the day before, a bystander had told the police they'd seen the exact car rubbernecking while driving past the crime scene, apparently acting suspiciously. So the police tracked the car down, and it led them to Andre.
And pretty quickly, they are asking him to retell the story over and over and over again.
Over and over, Andre told the police he'd borrowed the car from a friend. He went out that night, and on the drive home, he slowed down at the crime scene because he was curious. There were cops and bystanders. So he just looked and drove away. But the police weren't having it.
And every time he gives a version, they tell him, we don't like that version. We think you're lying. Tell it to us again.
And were you, you've never been in trouble with the law?
Never.
I feel like that's like the Twilight Zone.
It was. And I was lying. I kept telling him I didn't do nothing.
Andre insisted the night they were asking about, he'd been with Delonda's brother, Bobby Harrell Jr., partying at a nearby apartment. But that same night, someone had been brutally killed nearby, 21-year-old Anita Byington.
So she was a college student. She lived in, I believe, San Marcos, which is just south of Austin, and she was in town with two of her girlfriends, one of whom was her cousin, and they met up with a group of three guys that they had recently met to go out on 6th Street and go drinking. And she had called it a night a little bit earlier than the rest of the group, leaves the bar, goes to her car.
And from there, we don't know for sure what happened. But in the early morning hours of Sunday, August 11th, 1991, Anita was found beaten to death with a heavy slab of concrete. Her car, a 1989 brown Honda, was found parked 5 miles away. A day later, Andre was taken in for what was initially billed as a police interview.
And then from there, the interview, and I'm using quotes, I know nobody can see me, but I'm using quotes, quickly transitions to an interrogation. And that becomes a very extended, about 6 to 6.5 hour overnight process of going in and having two officers, eventually one officer, interrogate him back and forth, then leave him alone for a long period of time, not letting him really sleep though, having somebody come back in and out often.
These are common tactics meant to break people down. They also brought in Delonda's brother, who'd been hanging out with Andre the day of the murder, and questioned him too.
They're interviewing him in another room, coming back in and telling him, hey, your brother-in-law is saying the alibi that you're giving us isn't true. Your mom's denying it. We call that, he wouldn't have known this at the time, but we call that in this field false evidence ploys. So that's making a suspect think that something is true when it's not, to gauge the reaction. And then, of course, to try and get them to confess to what they think is going on.
But Andre kept saying he had no idea what was going on.
And then as Andre testified to at trial, there was a really critical part of the interrogation where he is alone with one of the main officers who threatens him with the death penalty.
Was that Polanco or was that?
That was Polanco.
Hector Polanco. Hector Polanco was an Austin Police Department patrolman and homicide detective with a reputation for getting a confession. After more than 6 hours of interrogation at the hands of Huckabee, Boardman, and Polanco, they typed up a statement and handed it to Andre.
At the time, did you know what that was?
No, I didn't. They told me, they said, well, this is your alibi. You sign this, you can go on, leave and go home. That's what I did.
He signed the document, what he thought was his ticket home.
He had been partying over the weekend, so he's exhausted, and he just wanted to end the madness and get it over with.
But the statement wasn't Andre's alibi, as police had told him. What it actually said was that Andre and Delanda's brother had beaten Anita to death after a drug deal gone wrong.
Did you ask them to read it to you?
No, I didn't even think about that. No, I didn't.
You just trusted them?
Mm-hmm.
So he signed without reading the document.
Because my reading was very poor at the time. Very poor. I had to take special classes, and reading was my worst.
So you signed it, and then you can't go home.
Yeah, I can't go home. They locked me up, charged me with murder.
Andre went to trial on July 14th, 1992.
There were two prosecutors. One was Terry Keel, and the second was a gentleman by the name of Reuben Young. And their trial theory was that the victim had approached Andre's brother-in-law for drugs, and that they were about to trade drugs for sex before the victim, quote-unquote, cheats him out of drugs and proceeds to get away, at which point the statement says, Andre's brother-in-law tells him, hey, she just tried to beat me for drugs, let's go get her, and that Andre subdues her and that his brother-in-law assaults her with the rain diverter to the point where it causes her death.
Was there any evidence of this?
No.
There also wasn't any evidence that Anita Byington had any history of drug use. At trial, Andre testified that he'd been tricked into signing a false confession, but the prosecutor said he was a liar and a criminal, and they put law enforcement on the stand to back their theory up. Cops, who Andre says he'd never met before Anita's murder.
It was crazy. It was really crazy. The picture they painted of me was really crazy.
What was that picture?
He had a police officer in uniform that took the stands, and so he stated my full name, and he asked, well, how did you know him? And he said, well, I knew him from drug, gang banging, and all type of things. And I'm like, nah, that's my lawyer looked at me, I said, that's not true. I said, that's not true. I ain't never had no run-ins with the cops. Never.
The other witnesses for the prosecution were people who said they'd seen Andre at the crime scene driving the Oldsmobile, suspiciously rubbernecking.
Driving by slowly, looking, interested.
As a normal person probably would when there's police around.
What literally every single person does in traffic when they see a car accident that causes, you know, miles of backup for no reason. Literally. Human nature. So he has a human reaction to seeing law enforcement and a big crowd of folks at a place that doesn't seem like that would be happening for any reason he's aware of, so he looks.
That, along with Andre's signature on a confession written by police, sealed his conviction. Andre was sentenced to 50 years in prison for the murder of Anita Byington. He was shocked.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. I'm the type of person that I don't believe in nobody hurting nobody, especially women. I'm not, if I'm around, I'm not just gonna let you hurt no woman. I'm not gonna do that. That's not right. No.
His family and friends were too. Delanda couldn't believe her Andre had been convicted of murder.
Because he didn't have an angry bone in his body. That couldn't be possible. I was like, how could that possibly happen? So, yeah, it was hard.
Now, prosecutors didn't just charge Andre. Remember, they'd accused him and Delanda's brother, Bobby Harrell, of killing Anita Byington. But almost 9 months after Andre's conviction, prosecutors dropped the charges against Bobby because they didn't have the evidence to take him to trial. Yet there was Andre, convicted of being Bobby's accomplice, staring down a natural life sentence for a crime he said from day one he didn't commit.
When did it feel real?
When I got to prison. When I got off that bus. in Midway, Texas.
Yeah, what was that like?
It was like, man, I'm in a world that I know nothing about. I'm dying here for something I didn't do. I don't know what the outcome or what I'm faced with right now, because I don't even know what I'm walking into. Most people, you got to be down with a gang. You got to be down with this. You got to be down with that. You got to do this. But
Andre says he was lucky. He got sent to a unit with a lot of young people. At 27, he was one of the oldest there.
It was a relief because when they found out how old I was, they all respected me. They all start calling me Unc and all this and that. They all respect me. Don't worry about nothing, man. We got you. You just do you.
Andre kept to himself and passed the time working and talking to Delonda.
How come you chose to stay with him after the conviction? I mean, you could have moved on with your life and not dealt with any of this.
Well, I know he was innocent, and I know he needed a support system. And I know I could give him that support, so I just stayed in that fight with him. I know he was innocent.
In the years Andre was in prison, Delonda had a child with another man. But her heart was always with Andre. And just like he'd done with her daughter, Andre would go on to love her little boy as his own. In 2000, Andre and Delonda got married. And Andre eventually got his GED after teaching himself how to read and write.
I would go to the library and get poem books and stuff like that.
He would copy love poems and send them to Delonda.
But I wouldn't copy them identical. I would try to make it my own. I would try the best I could.
Andre also tried the best he could to be a dad to his kids.
Every Christmas, we had this thing called Angel Tree down in prison. And as long as your kids was under 16, you put the application in and a local church will supply them Christmas presents and stuff. And that's what I would do every year.
As the years went on, Andre fought to get back home to his family. But he was denied parole at least 15 times. And every time, he'd think of Delonda.
Yeah, I just had to be strong for her. Every time I got a set off, I tell her, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. You know, we just got to keep moving forward. You know, we're not in control. You know, eventually, we're going to get what we deserve. You know, we just got to keep going. You know, but, you know, it was rough. I wanted to be home and, you know, like days like this, and I'd be looking outside. The grass is pretty and green. You're like, man, it's just beautiful. I need to be at home. I need to be at home. This is a beautiful day. You know, we all sit there and we'd be just sitting there talking about, man, we say, what would you be doing if you was at home? I said, I'd be with my family.
In 2018, Andre wrote the Innocence Project of Texas, and a year later, they wrote him back.
I got a letter back like the 4th or the 5th of 2019 saying they had accepted the case, and I just, you know, I like, thank you, Lord.
Yeah. So what stood out to you guys?
The fact that there was nothing else besides the confession, I think, was the first really big thing. Secondly, also a client with no criminal history that, you know, just all of a sudden is accused of murder, convicted of murder, and has a true narrative of innocence. And then, of course, once we get into it, we also start to learn about the law enforcement actors involved. So that was probably the third thing, which is Andre's story. In hindsight, with what we know now, the red flags were just incredibly loud.
Law enforcement officers like Hector Polanco, the detective I mentioned earlier. Polanco had been with the APD since the 70s and eventually became one of the department's star homicide investigators. But by the early 90s, several of his infamous case-solving confessions were coming under scrutiny. They just seemed too good to be true. And city officials started asking,
hey, what's going on at APD homicide? They're getting some really inexplicable, quote unquote, confessions from people where it's the only evidence. And then we're going back to check them and they don't look right.
In one case, Polanco interrogated a guy for 2 days and got him to confess to killing his girlfriend. Except the woman showed up alive a few days later. She'd just been away. Two more of those infamous false confessions were elicited during the investigation of the quadruple homicide of four teenage girls in an Austin yogurt shop, the so-called yogurt shop murders of 1991.
The one of the yogurt shop purported confessions is what ended up leading to the formation of the task force that ultimately revealed what was going on at the time. The thread between all of these are you have Polanco getting these confessions from murder suspects, and there's no other evidence to support that this person's confession is a true confession.
Jesse says that task force uncovered
extended interrogations, false evidence ploys, authorizing other officers to role play, to confuse suspects, and essentially trick suspects into thinking that their circumstances are something different than they are, threatening suspects with in-custody sexual assault, saying also, when we throw you in prison for the rest of your life, we're going to make sure there's somebody there to turn you out, making threats of the death penalty to suspects.
This is one of those suspects, Chris Ochoa.
That was saying, if you know who did it, and you don't tell us, you can get the death penalty. Like that was, I mean, that was like immediately within 10 minutes, the death penalty. You get the death penalty. If you know anything and you don't tell us, then we're going to go for the death penalty.
He was interrogated by Polanco in 1988.
It was a good cop, bad cop routine. The bad cop came in and grabbed my arm and tapped the vein on my, he said, this is where the needle's going to go if you don't cooperate and tell us. Like this is, and I'm going to make sure I'm there to watch.
Ochoa spoke to the Innocence Project in 2017, and he'd eventually testify at one of Andre's evidentiary hearings. Jesse says most of what happened to suspects like Ochoa happened to Andre.
We now know from the other cases that we now know about where innocent murder suspects were coerced by this unit to confess. We know that that was APD's pattern and practice at the time, which was Polanco would get a suspect alone. And then magically, you know, after that person is alone with him, quote unquote, confess. In Andre's case, his confession is ultimately given by his signature.
Believing in Andre's innocence, the team went back to the beginning, the evidence. There were three prints in Anita's car and semen found on her shirt and underwear. It didn't match Andre. But there was one person who couldn't be eliminated.
A member of the male group named Kevin Harris.
Remember, Anita was with her girlfriends having fun on 6th Street, one of Austin's known partying strips. They were also hanging with some guys. One of them was Kevin Harris, reportedly the last person to see her alive.
Was he a person of interest from the beginning?
So he was, but he was very, very responsible in terms of he knew not to interact with law enforcement without a lawyer. So he went to the police department, lawyered up, which was obviously very different from Andre's circumstances. He goes in three lawyers deep and gives a narrative that essentially accounts for what would otherwise make him look like he is the person who did this. He gives an account eventually that they had consensual sex that night. He has a visible injury on his arm that he gives a, I burned my arm making breakfast this morning story. All things that, again, absent coming in lawyered up, that if you were to give those accounts, that everybody would think that this is just not true.
We reached out to Kevin Harris through his attorney, who says Harris fully cooperated with the investigation 30 years ago, and he respectfully declines a request for comment. Jesse says instead of doing the actual legwork and investigating such an obvious suspect in Anita's murder, the police honed in on the easiest target.
What did you think about the police at the time?
Well, I just thought they was there to help the people. You know, to do the right things. I just thought they was there to do what they supposed to do. You know, get the bad guys. You know, but they had to just solve a case in a way they can.
While looking into Harris as the possible killer of Anita, Jesse and her team discovered that in 1999, he had been arrested for burglary with the intent to commit assault against another woman. And in that file was the name of a witness.
His on and off again girlfriend.
So they contacted her.
They had a pretty toxic relationship that ultimately escalated to an abusive relationship. And during that period where she was trying to break it off, but they were kind of coming back together, he had contacted her overnight and asked her for help moving a car. And she was able to identify the victim's car. Perhaps most importantly, though, she was also able to give a detail that law enforcement didn't know at the time, and that is also not accounted for in the statement. And it's that she saw a purse in the possession of the alternate suspect during the course of them moving this vehicle. And that was really important because the victim's purse was separated from her vehicle at some point and not recovered until months later by a Good Samaritan. So she was credible, she was truthful, and again, most importantly, she had information that she could only have had or known had she actually done what she told us she did, which was help the alternate suspect move the vehicle.
With all of this evidence pointing away from Andre, a judge ordered an evidentiary hearing. One of the world's foremost experts on false confessions, Richard Leo, testified that Andre's confession was, quote, extremely likely a false confession. He also noted that Andre has a low IQ, making him susceptible to manipulation. With that and the pattern of misconduct by the APD, particularly of Hector Polanco, Andre was released on parole in October of 2022.
My first meal when I got out, was it tacos? I think it was tacos. Yes.
It was tacos.
That's what I wanted, tacos.
He just loves my touch and cooking. That's what it is.
That's great.
Although her husband is out, it's bittersweet for Delonda, who has spent years defending Andre.
People need to hear his side of the story because you've tried to scandalize his name and he's been innocent all the time.
I imagine that doesn't feel great to have your husband's name.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But you know what? We smile with grace and keep moving. And you know, we do feel sorry for the Biden family, but they have the wrong person. And at some point, you're going to have to accept it and move on. And I think they owe you an apology.
But Andre just wants to focus on the things he's most cared about all along, his family. Andre tried to reach out to his biological son, who was 4 when he went to prison, but he hasn't heard back.
So my wife said, well, don't worry about it. Just get yourself together. And in time, you know, you'll try later on and reach out. I just been waiting for the right time.
In the meantime, he puts his love in the family he has.
Last year, June 16th, which was on a Friday, we renewed our vows, our wedding vows, because when we first got married, we got married at the courthouse, and I wanted to have my dream wedding.
And she did.
Good evening again to everybody. Thank you so much for being here on this evening as we have come together to witness the vow renewal of this amazing couple.
On their 23rd wedding anniversary, Andre and Delonda had their dream wedding.
For where you go,
for where you go,
I will go.
I will go.
Where you live,
I will live.
Well, we just do a lot of family things. You know, we go to a lot of her family's gatherings. We go to a lot of my family gatherings. And since we moved here, we start having family dinners and family days. You know, just enjoying the family.
And the fish.
And fish, yes. And the grandbabies.
Yeah, and the grandbabies.
Because of people like Andre, the Texas Innocence Project helped pass a state law in 2017, making sure the police always record interrogations for cases like murder. Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. This episode was written by me, Maggie Freeling, with story editing and mixing by senior producer Rebecca Ibarra. Our producer is Kathleen Fink. Our researcher is Hallie Dolce, with additional mixing by Josh Allen and additional production help by Jeff Clyburn. Executive producers are Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wurtis. The music is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Make sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
For decades, the mafia had New York City in a stranglehold, with law enforcement seemingly powerless to intervene.
It uses terror to extort people.
But the murder of Carmine Galante marked the beginning of the end.
It sent the message that we can prosecute these people.
Listen to Law & Order Criminal Justice System on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I am Lacey Lamar.
And I'm also Lacey Lamar. Just kidding, I'm Amber Ruffin.
What?
Okay, everybody, we have exciting news to share. We're back with season two of the Amber and Lacey, Lacey and Amber show on Will Ferrell's Big Money Players Network. This season, we make new friends, deep dive into my steamy DMs, answer your listener questions, and more.
The more is punch each other. Oh.
Listen to the Amber and Lacey, Lacey and Amber show on Will Ferrell's Big Money Players Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just listen, okay?
Or Lacey gets it.
Do it.
Welcome to the Ceno Show. I'm your host, Ceno McFarlane. I'm an addiction specialist. I'm a coach, I'm a translator, and I'm God's middleman. My job is to crack hearts and let the light in and help everyone shift the narrative. I want to help you wake up, and I want to help you get free. Most importantly, I don't want you to feel alone. Listen to the Ceno Show every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.